Chapter 6. Man and the Battle of Life. This appeared in the January edition, 15th January 1917. The Great War was a couple of years on by then. Clearly, Sri Aurobindo has couched his comments in the context of this largely European battle, although the Great War, as they called it at the time, did come into Africa and parts of Asia as well. It wasn't simply a European conflict, largely so. Then the Americans came. So, Man and the Battle of Life. Thus, if we are to appreciate in its catholicity the teaching of the Gita, we must accept intellectually its standpoint and courageous envisioning of the manifest nature and process of the world. This is one of his large points in the last chapter. The divine charioteer of Kurukshetra reveals himself on one side as the Lord of all the worlds and the friend and omniscient guide of all creatures, on the other as Time the Destroyer, arisen for the destruction of these peoples. Well, we've seen this cited before in the first chapter, in fact, the idea of the divine as Lord of all worlds, the universal friend. This is in chapter 5, the 29th shloka, where it says, translated into English, knowing me as the enjoyer, Bhoktaram, of offerings and austerities, the Lord of all the worlds, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, the friend of all beings, Suhrdam Sarvabhutanam, he attains peace. And then, of course, Time the Destroyer, that's chapter 11, shloka 32. Time the Destroyer, Kala, arisen for the destruction of these peoples as an element of the worldwide will of the divine. The Gita, following in this the spirit of the Catholic Hindu religion, affirms this also as God. It does not attempt to evade the enigma of the world by escaping from it through a side door. So he's used the term Catholicity and Catholic twice in a couple of sentences, and by that he means the breadth, the all-embracing, all-commanding reality of the divine being. And that if we're going to understand a teaching as large as the Gita's, we have to be willing to step outside of our small and human-based view of the world in terms of divided good and divided evil. We must see something beyond that. If, in fact, we do not regard existence merely as the mechanic action of a brute and indifferent material force, that would be prakriti, or on the other hand, as an equally mechanical play of ideas and energies arising out of an original non-existence, asat, or else reflected in the passive soul or the evolution of a dream or nightmare in the surface consciousness of an indifferent, immutable transcendence, which is unaffected by the dream and has no real part in it. So, Purusha as the passive soul, Brahman as the immutable transcendence, if we accept it all, as the Gita accepts, the existence of God, that is to say, of the omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, yet always transcendent being who manifests the world and himself in the world, who is not the slave, but the lord of his creative consciousness, nature or force, maya, prakriti or shakti, who is not baffled or thwarted in his world conception or design by his creatures, man or devil, who does not need to justify himself by shifting the responsibility for any part of his creation or manifestation on that which is created or manifested, then the human being has to start from a difficult act of faith. So this idea of a universal being, of a transcendence who has become cosmic, who dwells inside of all creatures and the immensity of the cosmos too, that everything is secretly embedded in this one divine being, may not be part of Shankara's Vedantic system, but it is very much an expression of Ramanuja's, and also later of Abhinavagupta in Kashmir. So Sri Aurobindo is in great company with those two philosophers. And in asserting that we have to accept the entirety of the divine and not simply an aspect of the divine to understand and act meaningfully in this world, we have, in fact, to perform a difficult act of faith. Finding himself in a world which is apparently a chaos of battling powers, a clash of vast and obscure forces, a life which subsists only by constant change and death, menaced from every side by pain, suffering, evil, and destruction, he has to see the omnipresent deity in it all, and conscious that of this enigma there must be a solution, and beyond this ignorance in which he dwells, a knowledge that reconciles, he has to take his stand upon this faith. Though thou slay me, yet will I trust in thee. All human thought or faith that is active and affirmative, whether it be theistic, pantheistic, or atheistic, does in fact involve more or less explicitly and completely such an attitude. It admits, and it believes, admits the discords of the world, believes in some highest principle of God, universal being or nature, which shall enable us to transcend, overcome, or harmonize these discords, perhaps even to do all three at once, to harmonize by overcoming and transcending. So we have to go through the difficulty to get beyond it, to really resolve it. We have to transcend, to climb, but that doesn't mean that we escape. It is a faith that is active and affirmative that helps propel us there to a knowledge that reconciles. So it is an active path. This is a sadhana. So the teaching of the Gita is a moksha dharma. It is a means, a lesson, a steadily revealed path in front of the aspirant, in this case, Arjuna, that leads step by step to a greater knowledge and a transcendence of the dualities, but a capacity to act within them from freedom because of identity with the Supreme Lord, described here as Maheshwara. Then, as to human life in its actualities. We have to accept its aspect of a struggle and a battle mounting into supreme crises such as that of Kurukshetra. The Gita, as we have seen, takes for its frame such a period of transition and crisis as humanity periodically experiences in its history, in which great forces clash together for a huge destruction and reconstruction, intellectual, social, moral, religious, political, and these in the actual psychological and social stage of human evolution culminate usually through a violent physical convulsion of strife, war, or revolution. So, Kurukshetra in the Gita represents a collision of many forces, and it is not simply a human stage which concerns the world. It is cosmic, and so concerns all, not simply humanity, but the gods, the devas and the asuras, and the Supreme Himself is intimately engaged in the conduct of this above, within, and down here in material form. This is suggestive of a larger cosmic purpose working itself out through this violent collision. And I do note that Sri Aurobindo observes here that this happens periodically in our history, but this is history as has been shaped by our masculine leaders. In patriarchal societies, this perhaps is inevitable. One wonders, because we have no record of this occurring in matrilineal societies, if it must be the fate always of humanity. And should one gender seize endless domination of the other, perhaps we will see a more harmonic outcome. But here we are. The Gita proceeds from the acceptance of the necessity in nature for such vehement crises, and it accepts not only the moral aspect, the struggle between righteousness and unrighteousness, between the self-affirming law of good and the forces that oppose its progression, but also the physical aspect, the actual armed war or other vehement physical strife between the human beings who represent the antagonistic powers. So there is a moral struggle and there is a physical consequence from the inner to the outer. From within, psychologically, to its expression in physical life. We must remember that the Gita was composed at a time when war was even more than it is now a necessary part of human activity, and the idea of its elimination from the scheme of life would have been an absolute chimera. Well, a chimera from Greek derivation is a fabulous fire-spouting monster, lion, serpent, goat, etc. So something that's hard to imagine, something that's hard to conceive, something one doesn't find. And so we do not find war as having been eliminated. War was a constant scene of life in ancient times, and I'm not sure that you can point happily to any period in these last couple of centuries where we have been absent war someplace on this globe. I just don't believe it. The gospel of universal peace and goodwill among men, for Without a universal and entire mutual goodwill, there can be no real and abiding peace, has never succeeded for a moment in possessing itself of human life during the historic cycle of our progress, because morally, socially, spiritually, the race was not prepared, and the poise of nature and its evolution would not admit of its being immediately prepared for any such transcendence. In other words, we're not ready for it. See how he's gauged this, morally, socially, spiritually, each one of them representing a different category of human existence. Even now, we have not actually progressed beyond the feasibility of a system of accommodation between conflicting interests which may minimize the recurrence of the worst forms of strife. And towards this consummation, the method, the approach which humanity has been forced by its own nature to adopt, is a monstrous mutual massacre, unparalleled in history, a universal war full of bitterness and irreconcilable hatred, is the straight way and the triumphant means modern man has found for the establishment of universal peace. Remember, this war, he's in the middle of it, began on the 28th of July, 1914, and continued till the 11th of November, 1918. So more than 4 years. That consummation, too, founded not upon any fundamental change in human nature, but upon intellectual notions, economic convenience, vital and sentimental shrinkings from the loss of life, discomfort and horror of war, affected by nothing better than political adjustments, gives no very certain promise of firm foundation and long duration. A day may come, must surely come, we will say, when humanity will be ready spiritually, morally, socially, for the reign of universal peace. Meanwhile, the aspect of battle and the nature and function of man as a fighter have to be accepted and accounted for by any practical philosophy and religion. The Gita, taking life as it is, and not only as it may be in some distant future, puts the question how this aspect and function of life, which is really an aspect and function of human activity in general, can be harmonized with the spiritual existence. Ah, quite a conundrum. And yes, war, whether it is outright or passively directed, is a dominant feature. This collision of ethical systems, of desires that demand gratification, whether that exists at the individual level, the social level, the national level, the global level, continues to beset us. So, Sri Aurobindo offers here that the Gita's solution is of a spiritual nature, but yet still deals pragmatically with the world as we find it, in fact. The spirit does not demand our withdrawal from this collision of forces, but our illumined action within it. In communion with the divine will, and not following our own egoistic or national prejudice. That may conform to such, but inwardly we must be aligned only with that. First with that, ever with that. The Gita is therefore addressed to a fighter, a man of action, one whose duty in life is that of war and protection. War as a part of government for the protection of those who are excused from that duty. debarred from protecting themselves, and therefore at the mercy of the strong and the violent. War, secondly, and by a moral extension of this idea, for the protection of the weak and the oppressed, and for the maintenance of right and justice in the world. Now, we'll have occasion, you know, momentarily and again later to talk about this old ideal that there would be a segment of society set aside that would do the dirty work of war and, so far as possible, leave the life in the rest of society alone. The warriors would fight and they would slay each other, but we would try not to destroy or pillage agriculture, destroy commerce, overturn civilizations, etc. Well, it's a convenient explanation. I'm not sure that we can cite history to support that. But it is an idea. Let's note here that Sri Aurobindo is writing about the kshatriya, the warrior, who is the leader of this portion of the Mahabharata, who is the figure with whom Krishna is speaking. Krishna too is a kshatriya. So if you're not familiar with it, there are four orders, four colors, chatur varna, in our typical classification of the Hindu social structure. The Brahman, the knower, the one who has knowledge, who has the power of the word, is the color white. The Kshatriya, for obvious reasons, who has the strength and who will keep together the nation and protect the small and the weak and those who need it, wears red. Those who work for the munificence, for the prosperity of the whole, are the Vaishyas, and they are garbed in yellow. And finally, those who serve, who work to make everything else function well, that class of service, the Shudra, is garbed in black. So these are the four colors. And I'll stay a moment more on this now. Sri Aurobindo's great book, The Mother, talks about the four aspects of the Divine Mother: knowledge, power, beauty, and perfection in work. And just so, these four idealized classes reflect powers of this goddess form. Each form, in a sense, takes its station in a certain aspect of human life. So Maheshwari dwells in the province of the Brahman. Mahakali supports and lifts up the ideals of the Kshatriya. The Vaishya pours wealth out on all through the grace of Mahalakshmi. And finally, in an ideal society, Mahasaraswati would arrange and time the perfect service of all things. So this idea of the four orders has, in a sense, a constellation above to which it refers. But here we are dealing with the Kshatriya, who has to protect, who has to go to war if necessary, to sustain society and to demand righteous action. So he continues, for all these ideas, the social and practical, the moral and the chivalrous, enter into the Indian conception of the Kshatriya, the man who is a warrior and ruler by function, and a knight and king in his nature. Although the more general and universal ideas of the Gita are those which are the most important to us, we ought not to leave out of consideration altogether the coloring and trend they take from the peculiar Indian culture and social system in the midst of which they arose. That system differed from the modern in its conception. To the modern mind, man is a thinker, worker or producer, and a fighter all in one. There you have it, all four. All in one. And the tendency of the social system is to lump all these activities and to demand from each individual his contribution to the intellectual, economical, and military life and needs of the community without paying any heed to the demands of his individual nature and temperament. The ancient Indian civilization laid peculiar stress on the individual nature, tendency, temperament, and sought to determine by it the ethical type, function, and place in the society. Nor did it consider man primarily as a social being or the fullness of his social existence as the highest ideal, but rather as a spiritual being in process of formation and development, and his social life, ethical law, play of temperament, and exercise of function as means and stages of spiritual formation. So one is born into a certain way and manner and style of living and function, but then one proceeds gradually to grow. So this indicates that one could climb, one could ascend, one could change. You weren't a prisoner of your birth. You began with a certain gotra. A gotra is a cow pen. And that is your dissension by birth. This is where you're clustered, but you, in a sense, can go beyond that. Look at the two great examples. We've already met one in the last chapter, Vishwamitra, who winds up in opposition with Vasishtha until he finally becomes a compatriot of Vasishtha and lifts himself from Kshatriya status to Brahman status. See also the nature of Satyakama Jabala, who was born at the lowest rungs of society, and by his presentation to his guru, by the very fact that he told the truth so utterly and straightforwardly that his teacher said, despite your gotra, you are a Brahman. Only a Brahman could say that. So one could transcend the place of one's birth and become something more because your temperament changed, because you demonstrated that your soul has outgrown a previous thing. And you should be in society what your soul fits you for. So he continues, thought and knowledge, war and government, production and distribution, labor and service were carefully differentiated functions of society, each assigned to those who were naturally called to it and providing the right means by which they could individually proceed towards their spiritual development and self-perfection. Yes, truly, we contain all those within us, but something in the soul wants to achieve a particular mission, and so summons forth elements which will match that aspiration and fit circumstances to it and develop powers from within and call upon resources from without to attain that goal. But we have to recognize what that goal is and what really is the soul's purpose in our birth. That kind of self-knowledge is what Arjuna needs now most. He is a Kshatriya, but he has been shaken by this challenge and by the adversity before him. The modern idea of a common obligation in all the main departments of human activity has its advantages. It helps to greater solidarity, unity, and fullness in the life of the community, and a more all-round development of the complete human being, as opposed to the endless divisions and over-specialization and the narrowing and artificial shackling of the life of the individual to which the Indian system eventually led. But it has also its disadvantages, and in certain of its developments, the too logical application of it has led to grotesque and disastrous absurdities. This is evident enough in the character of modern war. From the idea of a common military obligation binding on every individual to defend and fight for the community by which he lives and profits, has arisen the system by which the whole manhood of the nation is hurled into the bloody trench to slay and be slain thinkers, artists, philosophers, priests, merchants, artisans, all torn from their natural functions, the whole life of the community disorganized, reason and conscience overridden. Even the minister of religion, who is salaried by the state or called by his function to preach the gospel of peace and love, forced to deny his creed and become a butcher of his fellow men. Not only are conscience and nature violated by the arbitrary fiat of the military state, but national defense, carried to an insane extreme, makes its best attempt to become a national suicide. Let us rest there, and we'll finish the chapter next week. Carry that with you into the ironies of modern life. And see it from a spiritual compass. We must. So, to Savitri then, since we're on the theme of the battle of life, Book one, the book of beginnings. We're always beginning. Canto four, the secret knowledge. Let's start on page 58. Alive to the truth that dwells in God's extremes, awake to a motion of an all-seeing force, the slow outcome of the long ambiguous years and the unexpected good from woeful deeds, the immortal sees not as we vainly see. He looks on hidden aspects and screened powers. He knows the law and natural line of things. Undriven by a brief life's will to act, unharassed by the spur of pity and fear, he makes no haste to untie the cosmic knot or the world's torn, jarring heart to reconcile. In time, he waits for the eternal's hour. Yet a spiritual secret aid is there. While a tardy evolution's coils wind on, and nature hews her way through adamant, a divine intervention thrones above. Alive in a dead rotating universe, we whirl not here upon a casual globe, abandoned to a task beyond our force. Even through the tangled anarchy called fate, and through the bitterness of death and fall, an outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. It is near us in unnumbered bodies and births. In its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe the one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change, the crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. After we have served this great divided world, God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown, an anniversary of the birth sublime. Our soul shall justify its checkered walk. All will come near that now is naught or far. These calm and distant mites shall act at last, immovably ready for their destined task. The ever-wise, compassionate brilliances await the sound of the incarnate's voice to leap and bridge the chasms of ignorance and heal the hollow, yearning gulfs of life and fill the abyss that is the universe. Here, meanwhile, at the Spirit's opposite pole, in the mystery of the deeps that God has built for his abode below the thinker's sight, in this compromise of a stark absolute truth with the light that dwells near the dark end of things, in this tragic comedy of divine disguise, this long, far seeking for joy ever near, in the grandiose dream of which the world is made, in this gold dome on a black dragon base, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast, a dark-robed laborer in the cosmic scheme, carrying clay images of unborn gods, executrix of the inevitable idea, hampered, enveloped by the hoops of fate, patient trustee of slow eternal time, absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. All she foresees in masked imperative depths, the dumb intention of the unconscious gulfs, answers to a will that sees upon the heights, and the evolving word's first syllable, ponderous, brute-sensed, contains its luminous close. Privy to a summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise. And thus a poet reshapes our world. Namaste. Jai Ma.